This is tape 2, side 1 of The Impersonal Actor. Character. Perhaps the most perplexing thing to many is the concept of character as they are used to having it explained to them. Nothing seems to concern actors so much or to cause them to expend so much mental energy. Ironically, when one is shooting film, for example, character per se comes up infrequently because two things are well understood, the first of which is that what the character says and does is set forth by the writing, which remembers active and ongoing collaboration among writer, director, producer, and sometimes the star. And second, that after that has been put on film, the editor and the director will decide what of what has been shot will be seen as the character. There will be much discussion about what it is exactly you will be doing and what it is you will be communicating. But you'll find that a director is not usually so concerned with what your character is supposedly feeling. This is because the director is primarily interested in the clarity of the story and in the emotional effect the story has upon an audience. It is for this reason that a director should know well the difference between what is done and what is perceived, which we will later discuss. And I encourage you to go over that section repeatedly until it is well understood. A good director also knows that the last thing he wants is for a person to be sitting in a theater and know everything about the lead characters and what they are capable of. He knows that character is actually a process of unfolding, as opposed to a completed organism which moves from scene to scene. It's rather like one of those credit card folders that flops open one at a time, but ends up being 20 in a row, all connected. Well, character is the process of unfolding the cards one at a time. It is not the pack of cards moving from one emotional location to another. Tennessee Williams said, "Some mystery should be left in the revelation of a character in a play, just as a great deal of mystery is always left in the revelation of character in life, even in one's own character." How many times have you been watching a police drama, for example, and an important scene between leads is happening? A secondary lead walks on, delivering his lines in a manner which pulls too much focus to him, either because the lines are not done up to the speed of life, or because they're done too quickly, or because he's quirky in some way, or acting particularly odd to have this job, or being a little inept or disrespectful and grumpy, say, and suddenly your attention is away from the scene in which you'd previously been interested. Hamlet's speech to the players applies here. We'll discuss it later. But this is a perfect example of how disruptive a packet of character can be in a scene in which two other characters are unfolding. There is great wisdom in understanding the expression to play a part. It really means to be a part of something, to play a part in something in harmony. And more often than not, you'll need to focus much more on what your character does and says and less on who you think he is. For it is in what a person says and does, and in what others say about him, that character is revealed. It is exactly in this way that we know one another's character. The writing tells us which habitual actions and communications are to be portrayed. To portray excess or arbitrary traits can only cloud the picture. For the audience to have a clear impression, the ingredients must be clear. It is not character that someone has a limp. It is because one leg is shorter than the other. It is not character that someone has an accent. It is because he speaks English in the tune of his native tongue. If you wish, as actor, for your character to be clearly perceived by the audience, if you want your character's story to be told, if you want the audience to know your character's feelings, history, past, future, then your job will not be to portray a character as a whole, but as a singular unfolding per the instructions in the writing, moment by moment. Because your character is angered in scene 4 does not mean that he has a tendency toward anger in scene 1, visible or otherwise. Dramatically, the potency in your portrayal is in the unfolding, and the establishment of character traits, habitual behavior, by the writer, is the backdrop against which that unfolding takes place. We know a king primarily because he is treated like one. We know the new young member of the law firm is brilliant because his superiors defer to him. And if he's cocky, that isn't his character. It's because everything in life is going his way. You see the difference? What about abnormal people? The paranoid believes everyone is against him. The schizophrenic lives in a world that is grossly abnormal. The drug addict is constantly being chased. These are not definitions of character, but of the environment in which each believes he exists. You see? And anyway, most terribly disturbed people are not trying to go into themselves. They're trying desperately not to. Actors will do well to avoid, and directors will serve themselves by being on the lookout for, unintentional or even intentional attempts to emotionally and subtly give away what's coming in a story. An example would be if, say, a husband character brings his expectant wife to the hospital. He's nervous, of course, but expecting the best. There's nothing in the material to suggest that something is going to go wrong. The actor knows and has read that the baby is, in the subsequent scene, lost. He then subconsciously or consciously decides to darken his entrance with a foreboding tint of defensiveness or aggressiveness, arbitrarily giving his character a sixth sense that something is going to go wrong, even though the scene is not focused upon his character, but upon the attending physician who is the lead in our story and who also expects the best. He loads lines like, "I got here as fast as I could," and "traffic was impossible," so that the surprise is tipped off for the benefit of the supposed deepening of his secondary character. Interestingly, the payoff for such a weighted portrayal is negligible compared to, if correctly played in the opening scene, the husband is concerned but optimistic, by which he would have both set himself up for the fall, by contrast, and served the story by protecting the surprise. His character could then unfold for us with far greater dramatic amplitude when in the second scene, after having gotten the bad news, lines like, "This can't be happening," and "I don't understand, you said everything was fine," can be done again not aggressively, but from the shock and the disbelief, and with the irony that he thought everything was going okay. The dramatic contrast is now fulfilled, and it is exactly this which is usually given to us to act in good writing, as it is in life that shock and disbelief usually come before anger after a loss. An actor's best interests are always served in first serving the story, no matter the size of the role. A friend was once asked by a stage director who was growing increasingly perturbed with my friend's reticence to perform absurd shtick, what character was. My friend said he didn't know. The look on the director's face was reportedly one of utter shock and disbelief. How could he have erred so grievously in casting? He took a breath and started to tell my friend what character was so that he would know. "Character," he said, "is like a paper bag. First, you fill it with some canned goods. They provide the weight. Then you add the packaged items, like spaghetti and cereal. They provide the bulk. And as you continue to add things, the bag begins to fill up. It bulges out here, it gets lumpy there, and then finally you add the fruits and vegetables on top, and now you have an entire grocery bag of items. There may be 50 things in that bag, but they're each individual, and they're all in the same bag. That's character," he said, "and that's what you bring on the stage." He had it exactly backwards. That job has already been done by the writer. Or to extend an already preposterous metaphor into absurdity, the character is the taking out of items from a grocery bag to be revealed one at a time by the actor within the story, when and only when the writing says it shall be revealed. A better analogy is that the character is like a magician, fully loaded with tricks but looking unspectacular, revealing one mystery at a time, unexpectedly. Can you imagine a magician who's lumpy here and bulging there with yet-to-be-accomplished tricks? You'd know everything about him, wouldn't you? The character is already accomplished, isn't he? The only artistic issue is his revelation. Remember what Tennessee Williams said. You are already the person of your character. If you are playing a role, the person of the character you are playing is you. There's no one else there but you. So your portrayals by nature are already very personal. It is for this reason that your work, then, must be very impersonal, very universal, so that the you of the character is in harmony with the who of the character. The whole essence of what a character is and does depends on the element of revelation and the accumulation of knowledge in the audience's mind. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "The force of character is cumulative." Ernest Hemingway said, "When writing a novel, a writer should create living people, people, not character. A character is a caricature." End quote. Well, that goes for good acting as well. About Dr. Lvov in Ivanov, Chekhov said, "Neither right nor wrong, nor accurate nor inaccurate. Such persons are necessary, and for the most part sympathetic. To draw them as caricatures, even in the interest of the stage, is dishonorable and serves no purpose." Predictability is the death of character and the birth of caricature, and that, by definition, is a broad exaggeration based on reality but not itself something true. Not any more than you and I can know exactly what we will do in a certain circumstance beyond a shadow of a doubt can the person we are playing have that kind of insight into his future behavior. Often in playing a role, an actor prevails upon the writing and makes certain critical value judgments about his character. These usually are arrived at by asking a number of questions, beginning with, "What does he, my character, want?" The actor then decides, in effect, writes what his character wants, and then incorporates this information into a formula of a kind, which is supposed to somehow determine how the character will relate to others using the script as a kind of a blueprint. Thus, the portrayal does not so much depend at all on what is going on right now in the character's world, but on the overall issue of what the character wants from the world. Well, objectives and superobjectives are really moot for the actor, because we all really want the same things. We may not all agree on what truth, beauty, and justice are, for example, but we all still want truth, beauty, and justice. We may proceed with different agendas, but it's all on the way to wanting the same things, those being to live as long and happily and healthily and wealthily, depending only on your individual idea of abundance, and with the highest quality of life and learning we can obtain. And if you don't believe that, then find someone who's not mentally ill or suicidal who truly wants to live a short, sad, sick, poor, and stupid life. What is of interest to us, we human beings who share this truth of humanity, is not what people want, which is something we already know, but how we proceed on the path of life to obtain what is important to us in this life. There is the variety. To play what one wants is redundant. It's known. It is not the actable. Character in acting is something which best occurs in the mind of only two persons, in the mind of the writer and in the mind of the audience. Character is unplayable because the moment one plays at a tendency, assumes that their character can only do this or that, can only go this far because in another scene they only went that far, the character's officially a corpse. How often have we heard, "My character just wouldn't do that"? The moment the actor begins to think this way, begins to make a value judgment based upon his interpretation of the character's potential, it will unalterably affect his ability to play each moment without coloring it per his prejudice. To use our knowledge of a character's total actions as a means of playing the role is to rob the audience of the right to discover what we have the privilege of knowing. If we are playing a good, hard-working family man, we may well miss the cruel joke he makes in the second act, or see it but not do it, because he just wouldn't do that. Or how gently a vicious killer treats an old woman in the street, or how loving the mobster is to his own daughter as she descends the stairs to go to her prom, or how thoughtless a loving father is to a neighbor's kid who isn't good enough to play with his little boy. We miss seeing what are in reality dozens of subtle and delicate moments written often in material because we're treating our roles as caricatures instead of people who unfold before our eyes and surprise us moment to moment. In writing, hard-working, well-intentioned husbands do abuse their wives. Loving wives do cheat on their husbands. Honor students do drive drunk. True patriots are sometimes greedy, and the worst of us is capable of the kindest act of charity. These are the places that good writers begin, and they write them in ways which are surprises, not giveaways. It is the job, the privilege of an actor to protect and safeguard these surprises and all the other unfoldings which occur throughout an evening, so at the end of the evening, when the curtain comes down or the credits roll, the guy in the last row can nudge his wife in the ribs and say, "Hey, that was some character." Aristotle states, "Our characters are the result of our conduct." In his fine, insightful book on directing, David Mamet says, "There is no such thing as character other than the habitual action, as Mr. Aristotle told us 2,000 years ago. It just doesn't exist, here or in Hollywood or otherwise." It's ironic that there's been such a great deal made about building character, and that by the one element of drama which actually has nothing to do with the building of character, that being the actor. This concept may not sit too well at first, because it feels so terribly disempowering to the actor, but be assured that finally the reward for proceeding thus will be so gratifying. Writing designs how a character will actually build within the mind of the viewer, so that the audience, layer by layer, not the actor, constructs the past of your character and the future of your character. It is the audience who provides the history, the details of the person you're playing, and in this way the audience will get full value from the experience we'll call the dramatic event. American professor of drama and author George Pierce Baker said, "A play exists to create emotional response in an audience." If you, the actor, attempt to create your character's history, you'll endeavor to try to include it in the acting, which will invariably make unclear and muddled your execution of your character's actual present, his response to immediate stimuli, because you'll be trying to add to your character's reaction to current events your interpretation of your evaluation of your creation of his personal past. And in doing so, you'll rob him of the thing which you yourself in actual life insist is your right as a human being, and that is to be allowed to exist in the present. While it is absolutely true that an audience is never acted for, that is, never included in the truth or circumstance of your performance, it's so important that the viewer, whether in the theater or the movie house, is an integral part of the theatrical experience, the dramatic event, comedy or tragedy, and they must be allowed to play their role, as the writer plays his part, the director plays his, and the actor plays his. You wouldn't want another actor playing your part, would you? Stealing lines from you and the like? Shirley Booth said, "Actors should be overheard, not listened to, and the audience is 50% of the performance." Well, give to the audience what they've paid money to do, and that is to be themselves the other creative force, who supplies all the missing links and details, history and background, and all the possible motivations of the characters which may have not been supplied in the writing. You have so very, very much to do as an actor portraying a character, you really wouldn't have the time to play all the things you might arbitrarily create about your character, even if you could play them and even if it were your province to do so. Be satisfied that the viewer will himself provide a rich and profound completion of what you are not and were not ever intended to supply. Remember, the art occurs in the mind of the viewer. Let the impressions formed there be clear. And they will, if what you provide is crystal clear to begin with. Reflect on exactly what your agenda is as an actor. Is it to be emotionally moved, or is it to emotionally move? In serving an audience, which is the same as serving the story, you will serve yourself to the highest possible degree. It's the one way to guarantee that you come off a winner. Let's look at an illustration of what can happen if you underestimate or generalize about your character's potential. It's an example of how your character can be very good, quite entertaining, and highly satisfying to you, but because it's inaccurate, can turn the role into caricature and consequently tell the wrong story. I recently went to see a play in which the characters of a young man and a young woman meet and maintain a relationship over their respective balconies in a Chicago high-rise. A very funny and well-written play. The actors acquitted themselves nicely in terms of the acting that they were doing. They were finding a lot, but by no means all of the humor, and playing two fairly intelligent people. They were making the jokes and in general doing a good job of putting on the play. The problem was is that they were putting on the wrong play. You see, this guy hadn't gone out of his apartment for 7 months. Now, the actor decided that exacerbation of an already lingering dilemma, that being a personal shyness. an extremely attractive and charming shyness, as it was acted by this very talented actor. But what he was playing was that this basically very charming and disarming, intelligent and cute bookwormish writer of historical articles had finally had all he could take of the world, met the limit of what his shy nature could tolerate, and he finally checks out of society. Not a bad assessment. So that we have an attractive next-door neighbor who falls in love with him and tries to save him from a wasted life, a kind of American Pygmalion with reversal of the sexes. A nice story, but not the story. The real story is funnier and a bit more disturbing because it's applicable to far more people. In fact, any and all of us. You see, what this story is really about is a normal, rather gregarious, educated and sexy young red-blooded American male who is positively confident and at ease, a man's man, a woman's man, charming, funny, winning, poised, and witty. All of these things he is, as long as he's in his own apartment. You see, this isn't the story of an agoraphobic. It isn't so much a study of neurosis, but is a tale about a normal man who no longer trusts. This isn't a story about a clinically diagnosable psychology, but one of spiritual starvation. He feels herded in food lines, crowded in video rental stores, imposed upon by car horns, and intimidated in turn lanes. What he is socially gun-shy, and of course, in a way, who can blame him? We all understand. While only few of us are really shy, each of us has experienced a bully world gone insensitive. The next-door neighbor, with whom he eventually gains trust and with whom he falls in love, succeeds in encouraging him to start again on the road outside, to accept what he can't change as a part of a bigger picture. Then he'll begin to again do his part so that good guys also define the world. Now, you see, we have a story about the redemption. Remember, we discussed this before, about the redemption of someone's trust in humanity, rather than the charming but less poignant story of the boyish man who learns to come out of his shell. The story of one who was lost and is now found, as opposed to the story of one who was never lost, just living on the fringe. This misassessment happened because the writing was not looked at clearly enough to see that it was not a charming cliché, but something a great deal more profound and applicable to us all in some way. So then your technique is to look for your characters to be about the whole of humanity, rather than about those with interesting but unusual and unique behavior. You'll find that writing is more by far about the former. In review, 1. Character, dramatically speaking, is an effect caused to occur in the mind of an audience. In this way, it is the art of drama. 2. Play your role as intelligently, winningly, and wittily as the script allows, so that when they are not these things, it will, by contrast, have meaning. 3. Be concerned more with what your character is doing than with what he is feeling. The audience knows what he is feeling when they're supposed to, and when they're not supposed to, you're not to give that away. 4. Always play the potential of your character, not his limitations. That is to say, for example, rather than play a drunk stagger, you play his attempt to walk straight. Rather than play a man who's almost blind, play someone trying to get around in the dark. Rather than play someone who can't read, play someone who is trying to make words from writing. Rather than play someone who is lost, play someone who is looking for a way, figuratively and literally. Apply the previous evaluation technique to every role you play, and you'll begin to find everything that is truly actable in your part. This is the end of Tape 2, Side 1 of The Impersonal Actor. We'll continue on Side 2.